Good morning. This is Tom Merritt, host of Daily Tech News Show, Cord Killers and Current Geek, and author of Pilot X, now available at TomMerrittBooks.com. And you are listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'll see you in the future.
Good morning! Welcome to Too Much Scrolling for March 13th, 2018. I'm Steve Fodor.
And I'm the Leprechaun.
Just a couple of guys sitting around talking about things that are important to us. Hopefully they're important to you. And if you need more information, there's so many great ways to find more information.
Yeah. The rainbow? Running.
That's a great place to find more information.
You can find a pot of gold
if you're really lucky. That's right. It's St. Patrick's Day this weekend. Happy Ides of March, everyone, this weekend. Watch out for people behind you with knives.
Grab a beer at some point.
Yeah. It's also show week. So
it's show week.
Yeah. So Chip's going to say a lot of stuff this week.
We're going to have a good time. If it's show week.
Yeah.
Then Steve, we should recognize that Steve's not going to have a lot of energy towards the end of the week. But that's an exciting time. It's worked a long time for this.
We've been working so hard trying to get this put together, and I'm really excited. If you're in the area and you want to see a really good show, come to my school. It'll be great.
Film at 11.
Brings us to our film at 11, our movie of the week. You have taken a journey this week.
A journey, Steve.
Looking at what could happen if the end of the world came. What chances would you have? You read the book I Am Legend a month or so ago, right?
Yeah, we reviewed it here.
Yeah.
And that was pretty good. And then I watched my course on dystopian and utopian literature.
And this led you to a film festival this week.
A film fest.
Yeah.
The Leprechaun Film Fest.
You took a journey through all of the different movies that were inspired by I Am Legend. You started with The Last Man on Earth, a 1964 classic.
Vincent Price.
Vincent Price.
That's right. Ah, ha, ha, ha. Oh, Vincent Price.
You know that guy from Thriller, that rapper?
That's the guy.
Yeah.
That's the guy. Yeah, it came out in 1964. Now, I watched it on Fandor, mm-hmm. which is, once again, that service that we got. It's a monthly service, but we got it at no extra cost with our movie pass.
Right.
Now, I also found it on Amazon Prime. So if you have that app available to you on your television or tablet or phone, there's a colorized version if you prefer to watch it in color, but I watched the black and white.
And you said it was a really crisp, nice picture on that one.
Oh yes.
Yeah.
And this one is pretty faithful to the story, I Am Legend, as I remember it.
Mm-hmm.
So we definitely have Vincent Price as the last man on Earth. He goes out during the day. He brings his spikes. He's going to hunt down these zombies / vampires,
right?
And brings back cloves of garlic, hangs it up with mirrors. There's
a dog. Sure.
And eventually there is the revelation, and I don't want to give away the spoiler, but the revelation is he's actually the last man and he's the outcast.
Wow.
So I thought this was a very nice production. And then, you know, we can compare it to our next production that came in 1971.
Yes, The Omega Man. This is maybe the one that most people have heard of. Maybe not the 1964 Vincent Price. This is the Charlton Heston edition, The Omega Man.
My cold, dead hands.
Different movie. Actually, that was real life, wasn't it?
I think it was.
That wasn't even a movie, was it? Oh, there you go. That's the one.
Anyway, this is Charlton Heston. And, you know, he did Soylent Green and Planet of the Apes.
Right.
I mean, he was like, this is part of the many movies he did. And this is definitely the sweaty 70s, 70.
Isn't it funny how every one of these movies features a very dirty, sweaty, shirtless Charlton Heston just getting through whatever situation he's getting through? That was the 70s.
Now, you know, Vincent Price is very refined. Right. His shirt's untucked. But, you know, the deal is you can tell he's bathed. But Charlton Heston, they went right there for it. And, you know, the scene he's driving around with the beginning of the movie, he's driving his car through this empty city. And then as the music ends, I can't think of the song they were doing. But anyway, it was certainly, A Summer Place. It's, you know, there's a summer place. Anyway, it's this beautiful. And then he stops with a machine gun and shoots it through the window and then takes it. What is interesting, the next scene is he's driving really fast through this empty city, drives up in a curb and blows a tire. So what does he do? Well, there's no one else around. He goes to the car dealership and gets the new car and, you know, hot wires it and takes it off.
Did you ever watch the Last Man on Earth series on Fox, the comedic version of this?
No.
The idea of getting whatever car you want is certainly expressed in there. They drive very nice cars.
This is a nice production too, but it's definitely 1970s. He finds out it's Sunday, and by the way, you drink a lot of scotch. And you're shirtless quite a bit.
If you're the last man on earth, yes.
He drinks a lot of
scotch.
You
drink a lot of scotch and you're shirtless often.
And that's really odd. If I was the last man on earth and I'm fighting for survival, I don't know if scotch would take the edge off. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I need the edge taken off. I kind of need to be aware of what's going on and control.
Yeah.
Oh, anyway.
So you take up smoking maybe.
It's Sunday. And he says, oh, Sunday I dress up for dinner. And so he goes back, and he comes back, and he's got this, it's so 70s, this ruffled colonial shirt on, this velvet colonial jacket on. I mean, it's just so, I need one of these for Halloween.
I don't want to be a pirate.
It's so awesome. Anyway, this is a different production because we actually get the vampire / zombie perspective. They're actually characters in this, where in Vincent Price's version of The Last Man on Earth, we never really get to meet them until we get the sort of a revelation. With this one, we automatically get what's going on. There's very much of a Cold War. You know, we're fighting the USSR. It's religion. You know, the science has failed us, and so we must adopt a religion. And the only way to adopt a religion is to abandon science. Hmm. And so they capture him and try to kill him. And they change the book some. It's sort of... It'd be better to say it's inspired by. It's got a lot of the elements of the I Am Legend, but certainly not perfect.
Then you got to see the movie that is called I Am Legend. This is the 2007 Will Smith.
That's right.
I really enjoyed this one, so I want to hear if you did.
All right, so this is the third, and I watched them back to back to back. So.
Oh, boy. That's a nice afternoon.
So what we should know about
little
this...
Little scotch, your shirt off.
That's right. Damn dirty apes. Is that certainly our manliness has changed quite a bit.
Yes, it has. Since the Charlton Heston 1970s.
Will Smith is in his lair. You know, and he's running in the treadmill. He's trying to keep up with... he's a scientist in a different way than Vincent Price and Charlton Heston are. It's very much... an era of its CGI, so I did not see it when it originally came out, but it's capable, and he's not really hunting as much as Charlton Heston and Vincent Price hunted down these creatures.
Okay,
it's kind of a different story too, even a different end as a twist. You know, he became the donor of the solution for the new men as they arrived.
He was the scientist who discovered what could be done, what was really happening, and what could be done to solve it, as opposed to what you said with the Omega Man, where they said they rejected science for religion.
So this came out in 2007. Mm-hmm. I think of Detroit probably as a good example of an abandoned city. Well, nature comes in and takes over that. And we get a lot of that. The grass is growing through the asphalt. There's wild animals. In fact, there's a lion scene in the I Am Legend.
Escaped from the zoo and is roaming the streets,
And, you know, Will Smith is racing through this empty city, chasing deer, like a whole herd of deer, trying to get one because that could be dinner.
Mm-hmm.
So you get sort of a, you know, return to nature kind of review to it. We don't get any real idea of what's going on with these zombie vampires. There's a nest of them somewhere. He's looking for it. But, you know, are they capable of thinking? Are they doing any more than existing? Are they any more than animals? We don't know.
The whole question of whether or not they set a trap for him with the mannequin is questioned in I Am Legend.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
Because... that's one of the things that happened. In fact, let's go back to the Omega Man. There's a scene where it's at the end of the day. You know, it's not dark time. It's not dark yet, Steve. But I go into a store and I'm wearing my tracksuit with my trainers, And I take off the tracksuit. So now I'm shirtless with, you know, the sweaty hair, you know, all over my body. And then he goes and he's trying on different sweatsuits. Like, which sweatsuit am I going to take this
which
time?
Which one will soak up this sweat the best?
So, you know, at the end of the world, what ends up happening? You don't care about, you know, keeping everything organized. You just basically go and take. It's different in I Am Legend. I Am Legend, the movie from 2007, is much more inspired by the Omega Man movie than I think that the I Am Legend book.
The original book.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's echoes of those in both of productions, but they changed some things. Definitely, you know, we're dealing with a 1950s story that was sort of the beginning of the zombie-ish.
And then told in the 60s, yeah. Told in the 70s, and then told again in the aughts. That's pretty interesting. So if I only had 2 hours, I have to choose one of these three. Is there one that is clearly the superior product?
No. I think you could pick any one of them. If you were with younger people, I think the 61 version is probably the most gentle version.
Okay.
But they're going to get bored because it's got the pacing of a 1961 movie.
Yeah.
Then the 2007 story is going to, maybe too intense because of how they chose to do the CGI.
Mm-hmm.
And the 1971 one, you
have to be a fan of Heston.
Well, no, Heston works real well. The bad guys, You get an idea. There's nothing truly graphic about it.
Okay.
And when you turn into one of these zombies, what do? They paint you white and they put some scabs on your face. So it's really not that scary.
Okay.
And blood is that bright orangish red. Totally fake
70s blood.
They certainly don't make it look like, you know, today. Today they could, like Hacksaw Ridge. Uh-huh. If you remember that, it looks like hamburger.
Yeah.
No.
It's not like that.
No. This is much more, it looks fake. But I think that the hokiness of it may be something that doesn't grab them either.
Okay.
So anyway, I enjoyed all three of them. I liked it because, once again, I read a book and then saw a bunch of productions that were inspired by it.
Very interesting. There's lots of inspiration this week in the movie theater. We have some movies opening. The first one is Tomb Raider. You know, the 2018 movie about the pretty girl who is a archaeologist and goes on an adventure.
Steve, I don't know about you, but I'm going to grab a tank top and my Daisy Dukes and head down to the theater.
That's
dressed as a leprechaun. I'm just little. I'm a little guy.
I wonder why they're making another Tomb Raider movie. Wasn't the Angelina Jolie Tomb Raider movie enough for you?
It almost should be that this should be the introduction to get you to playing the game. And
right.
I don't know if that's the case. I don't know if they're bringing out a new one. But it just seems like
another video game movie.
Yeah, kind of Indiana Jones-ish.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe not as
but
good.
But not quite the same level. It'll be
with
great.
With a tank top and Daisy Dukes.
Which makes perfect sense.
Of course.
Maybe it'll be great. Maybe we're judging. But Tomb Raider's opening this week. We'll put it that way. There's another one called 7 Days in Entebbe. This is the true story of a hijacking of an airliner in 1976.
The sweaty years, Steve.
Back to the sweaty years, where the hijackers brought this plane to Entebbe, Uganda, and held these people hostage, and an elite force of soldiers had to come in and rescue them.
The Israeli soldiers, the super soldiers, came in.
Oh, I thought it was the A-Team.
Oh, the A-Team. Probably. This is based on a true event that happened. This is about the rescue mission.
Yep.
If you're going to see a movie this week and this interests you, I'm sure it's going to be pretty good.
Okay. There's one called Love, Simon.
The young adult
This
version.
Is the young adult film of the week. This is about a young man who is responding to messages online because his life is very complicated and the internet changes his life.
This is a high schooler who is gay.
Oh.
And somehow it comes out, or he releases the information he's gay, and basically the ramifications of it with his very good life, with the exception of his one secret.
Yeah.
We knew there was going to be movies like this at some point. This is sounds like maybe the same writer or the same director who did Fault in the Stars.
Mm-hmm.
It's aimed at my daughter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is not a movie for us. No. But it might be great. Who knows?
Who knows?
There is one called Journey's End. This is based on a stage play. It's about World War One, a group of British officers, and how they can become a ragtag. I don't know. It's about war.
It's about war. It's a stage play. It's got a limited release. It actually looks pretty good. If I was going to go to the movies this week, this is what I would seek out.
Over Tomb Raider. Okay.
I could probably wait on Tomb Raider or not see it.
Yeah.
But some people will want to see it, and it probably would be the biggest release of the week.
This is one of those weeks where there's small niche movies for every different group of people. The video gamers get their movie, the young teenagers get their movie, and the people who love World War One, because there's a lot of World War One fans who will go see that movie.
Or maybe you go see Black Panther again.
That'll probably be the right choice. Book it. Our guest today is Luke Schaefer, Associate Professor of Social Work at the University of Michigan. We became familiar with his work when we reviewed his book, $2 a Day, Living on Almost Nothing in America. Thank you for being our guest, and welcome, Professor Schaefer.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be with you guys.
We really enjoyed your book, and the beautiful part of today's world is that we can reach out and we can schedule these wonderful interviews.
That's right.
Yeah.
All right. So why don't you tell us a little bit about this book, $2 a Day, Living on Almost Nothing in America?
Yeah. So throughout my career, I've been studying poverty in the United States and our social safety net and how it works well and how it can work better. I've done most of my work as a data nerd. I love spreadsheets and large rows of data. It makes me feel warm and cuddly inside. And my colleague, Kathy Eden, her research technology, if you will, was a little bit different. When she had questions about what it was like to experience poverty in the United States, she would actually go out and talk to people. So this was a little, might seem self-evident to everyone else, but a little uncommon in the academy. Well, she told me, after 25 years of talking with poor families all around the United States, that when she and I met up in 2011, she was seeing something different, something that she was seeing families who weren't just poor by American standards, but who were deeply, deeply poor, and poor in a particular way, in that they lacked access to money. They lacked access to cash. They might have food stamps, and their kids might be able to get school lunch meals, school breakfast, but what do you do in 21st century America without cash? So the first step was to look back at the large-scale data and see, had there been a change? Were there more families who were cashless? And if there were, how did they get that way, and what did they do to survive? So we went to, over the course of a couple of years, we went to just about every data source we could find. And across them all, we see this doubling, in some cases, when you deal with some of the noise in the data, actually tripling in the number of families experiencing a spell under $2 per person per day. And we're talking about millions of people, millions of kids, about 3 million at the cap in the height of the Great Recession. And,
wow. That's roughly double from the 1.5 million that was potentially experiencing
this
before.
Yeah. And we actually think that our original estimates probably understated the change over time, as we've been able to find administrative data from the SNAP program that records under penalty of law people saying what their income is when they apply for SNAP. It looks like it might be a tripling, actually, over a 15-year period in families like this. So, we really wanted to understand what can explain this. What does this look like in America? And so we thought that went back to sort of Kathy's research technology. So we went to Chicago, which is one of our favorite cities. I had done graduate school in Chicago, so had Kathy. We went to Cleveland, down to Appalachia, and then down to the Mississippi Delta. And we partnered with family shelters and feeding programs and just asked families who fit this profile to tell us about their lives. And we promised to tell their stories in an honest but respectful way. And so $2 a day really follows about a half a dozen of the of the families who we interviewed and tries to chart their stories and then put it in the big picture frame of the large scale data.
In fact, let's go back to this $2 a day. That would be bus fare to get from, you know, point A to maybe school or to work or something of that nature. The little necessities that individuals need day to day that just don't fall into where SNAP, food stamps would come right. into, or a housing right. allowance would come into.
Right, exactly. So, and, you know, some of the things we saw was, as you said, the necessities of life, trying to keep your kids in fresh underwear, toilet paper, toothpaste. And so, you know, I think probably the best evidence that we found that cash really matters in 21st century America is the lengths to which families would go to generate just a little bit of cash to get through the next day, to maybe pay the utility bill one more month or maybe pay their rent one more month before they have to scoot off somewhere else. So just to give you guys one example and why I really came to think that qualitative work was so incredibly important, as I started interviewing, you know, especially the moms we met in Chicago, you started to see these little divots on the inside crease of elbows. And the first time I saw it on the first person, it was summer, and so everybody was wearing T-shirts. I thought it was, oh, you know, a drug track line, and there was a substance abuse problem, and that explained some things. But then when you started to see it and started to hear the stories, we quickly learned that those were scars from selling blood plasma mm-hmm. so often. That Jessica Compton, who we met in Appalachia in Johnson City, Tennessee, she, all of the money that was coming into her household was from her selling her blood plasma twice a week, as often as the law would allow. So that was something, you know, here I am, a poverty expert, I knew nothing about. I knew nothing about the plasma industry, yet when you go back to the data, you see that the number of plasma sales in the United States has just about tripled over the last decade to about 38 million in 2016, that the United States actually accounts for about 70% of the worldwide production of plasma wow. and only about 40% of the demand. So we are a plasma exporter. We actually export the blood plasma mainly of poor Americans all over the world. Here is this whole entire embedded system where you have Fortune 500 companies that are doing very well and you know, a safety net of sorts that is just very real, but that people really don't know about here in 21st century America.
So is there a specific thing, a policy change or a demographic change that has led to this rise in extreme poverty?
We trace it to really three factors. Probably the most important is the 1996 welfare reform. Now, mm-hmm. I want to say that in the 1990s, the federal government did a lot of good things for poor families. They expanded this thing called the Earned Income Tax Credit that supplements your wages if you find a job and keep a job. And it's really effective and quite successful in improving outcomes for families, but it's not a safety net in that when your earnings fall to zero, your EITC falls to zero. We also expanded access to public health insurance, and we now have seen sort of rates of health insurance coverage for low-income children just really go up, and I think that's been a bipartisan success. But one thing that Kathy and I think did not work out well was the 1996 welfare reform. Mm-hmm. That took an unpopular program, aid to families with dependent children. It was a cash welfare program, what a lot of people think of as welfare. You get a check for being poor. And we replaced it with a block grant program where the federal government essentially said, you know, here, states here, Illinois, here's, you know, your fraction of $16.5 billion, and you can spend it on cash assistance if you want. And if you do, we're going to impose a lot of requirements that you get people working, or you can keep your caseloads very low and use the money for other stuff. And so I think we see a really good example of a policy when there's too much flexibility and states are given these choices that a lot of states have chosen to just keep their can of caseloads extremely low. According to official statistics, a huge fraction, only about less than a third of eligible families are getting it, down from, I think, 66 to 70% 15 years ago. And in some cases, the program has, as we said, virtually vanished from states. So we think that, that you can really see it in the data that the families who are hit hardest are the ones in the states that have seen this, the biggest decline in this particular program. And, you know, single-parent families have been hit the hardest. So that's a big piece of it, a really important piece. The second piece is just the instability in the low-wage labor market. So because of the EITC and because of other changes we made in the 1990s, there was a big increase in work effort among poor families over that period of time. And a lot of people really herald that as a success, but the jobs that especially at the very bottom they have to rely on are unstable with schedules that shift from week to week in the number of hours and the timing of hours. And then you combine that, I think, with unstable family lives, and you just are destined to see these moments of crisis when people who are working sort of flame out of jobs. And the, what differentiates the extreme poor is they're the ones who sort of fall all the way down to the bottom. And finally, I just mentioned the affordable housing crisis. So we've seen this huge run-up in the cost of housing relative to incomes. And so we're seeing just a tremendous amount of residential instability, which often takes the form of temporary double-ups, you know, where our kids and families are moving from couch to couch. And we know that there's a lot of ripple effects of this in health and educational outcomes. And so I think we think of these three factors as like the three-legged stool driving what we see in the book.
What surprised you most when you were interviewing these families, what you learned about them?
When we first started interviewing families, I had not sort of made the connection that this was, that the folks we were going to meet were going to be primarily people who thought of themselves as workers. They wanted to be working. And so, you know, the typical story of falling into an extreme spell of $2 a day poverty started with the loss of a job because of instability in the job or instability in family life and sort of a spiraling down from there. But we weren't really expecting this to be a story. You know, you often heard that the people who didn't do well as a result of the welfare reform were people with multiple barriers to work, and that may be true, but these were almost always people who thought of themselves as workers and who wanted to be working. And when we'd ask people if we came back in a year and you were doing well, they would strikingly to a person say, oh, I'd be working in a job with stable full-time hours paying $10 to $12 an hour. That was the range that we heard.
Wow.
And so that was a very, you know, it just struck me that that was their vision of the American dream. The other thing I would say that totally surprised me was the level of trauma and history of abuse that I really hadn't, I think, been exposed to, even as a poverty scholar. You know, in a lot of cases, we saw that these sort of moments of crisis when families were already hurting, they would find themselves in situations where they were just, you know, they were vulnerable to be taken advantage of in some way. So you all read about Jennifer Hernandez sort of walking in on her uncle, who she thought would be a good role model for her kids, but who she found molesting her 9-year-old daughter. Those types of stories were ubiquitous. And so that really got me into a vast literature on adverse childhood experiences, which are experiences of physical, sexual abuse, maltreatment. And it's kind of surprising and actually shocking what big a fraction of the population reports those types of experiences and how much of a relationship there is between those types of experiences and long-term outcomes. And in our case, we think, you know, this is something that's in the experiences of far more Americans than I think we would like to admit. And it's especially so among the extreme poor, a group that's often under stress, you know, because of lack of resources, often vulnerable to abuse and neglect.
In all your work, have you come up with a solution to this extreme poverty, or is there something a family can do to lift themselves out of this situation?
Yeah, you know, we really started with what they told us was their goals, and it had a lot to do with stable employment. So we've been doing a lot of work, and there is some history of successful programs that provide both subsidies to, you know, partnerships with employers. And one of the great innovations recently has been the pairing of that with success coaches. So success coaches are generally thought of as people sort of in the employment setting who might come alongside a family and help them problem solve. So Ray McCormick is one of our moms in our book, and she lost her Walmart job because she got into the truck she shared with a family member and found that the gas tank was empty.
Yeah.
And her manager said, if you can't get in today, don't bother coming in again. And, you know, we just think if there had been someone that she could call who could help her problem solve, you know, what are the resources at my disposal to get myself to work? Or, you know, how do I interact with the manager to, you know, make it so that we can make this work? Maybe that would have had a better outcome. So we think that is a really important sort of line, because it's not what we think, you know, necessarily what our focus would be on, but what the family's focus would be on was trying to improve labor market outcomes. Now, believe that there needs to be a cash safety net. Yeah. And I've really come to think, you know, I'm a policy wonk, and so my inclination is to, you know, use precise schedules to have a policy be as effective and efficient as possible. Out of this project, I really grew to think that sometimes simpler is better. So what a lot of Western industrialized countries do is they say, hey, raising kids is expensive, and we think the government has an interest in improving outcomes for kids. So they provide a modest stipend to families with kids called a child allowance or a child credit. Canada does this. Great Britain does it. Many, many places. And the United States has sort of a policy of sorts through the child deduction and the child tax credit, but families at the very bottom don't get it. And so a number of my colleagues and I actually have a paper coming out this week that proposes a child allowance that would just be a very simple $250 cash stipend. It would be stable to deal with some of this volatility that these families are experiencing, and everybody would get it. And we were really pleased that it has gotten some coverage in the New York Times and Vox, and it's actually a version of it was introduced as legislation by Senator Michael Bennett and Senator Sherrod Brown in the Senate, and we're hopeful that sometime in the future we might get to something like that, a simple policy that would virtually eliminate the kind of poverty that we're talking about in the book.
In fact, I wanted to go back to something you mentioned, the young lady who did not have gas in her tank to go to her job, and you know, she called in. The employer basically said, "Don't come in if you can't get in."
Yeah,
she had budgeted out her resources, and she had put the fuel. She filled the car up with fuel. It just happened to be that other people in the house took that vehicle and used all the fuel during the weekend. So it shows just how painful it can be. Even when you plan out everything. And so this, it sounds like with the proposal that this being made, the $250, and that while that certainly sounds very modest, that could be the difference between helping the child have something or going without. I mean, everything becomes a much more volatile situation.
Yeah, it was, you know, I think that in that case too, we heard for that story played out all over our field sites of, you know, you just have families, and you see reports of this really far up the economic ladder, that families don't know where they would turn if they had an emergency of a few thousand dollars. Mm-hmm. Families that are just really operating on what they see as a razor thin margin. And interestingly, Pew did a survey a little while ago that asked families, would you rather the government pursue policies that enhance economic mobility or increase financial security? And something like 90% of Americans said, I want to increase financial security. So these simple types of policies, you know, things that you can count on in a world when, you know, so much else is uncertain, I think are really appealing to families.
So is there hope for these people, for the extreme poverty situations that we're seeing, the examples, the stories that you're telling in your book?
Yeah, you know, we see some of the families who we've stayed in touch with are doing better. We're able to find jobs, although, you know, we see cases where people have found jobs, but they're unable to still afford a place to live. Tabitha from the Mississippi Delta is at college, actually, in that case. She had really the committed support of a teacher, Mr. Patton, who she met, who's really looked out for her and helped her navigate all of these processes. that it takes to get into college, it's a tough road, I think, because of the compounded disadvantage that families face. But you know, we have lots of evidence that the things that we do can matter. So we have lots of evidence that early childhood education, intensive early childhood education can matter. We have a lot of growing evidence that providing cash, you know, the type of very simple safety net, keep it simple, can really matter a great deal. You know, there has been a lot of increased interest in those types of proposals for combating poverty, and I am hopeful that in the long term that we can do better by people like Ray and Jennifer Hernandez and Madonna Harris.
Wonderful. So we can leave our listeners on an up note. There is hope. Maybe we can do something together for this. Where can our listeners find more information about your work?
Yeah, well, you can check out, if you want to learn more about the book, you can check out our website, $2aday.com. It's all spelled out. And I'm directing a new center here at the University of Michigan called Poverty Solutions, and you can check out poverty.umich.edu. And here we're really looking at concrete strategies to do just what we were talking about here in the last question, to really, you know, address some of these very concrete issues like affordable housing and how they impact families with real tangible solutions. And, you know, we're really excited that I think this type of way of looking at things really sort of cuts across political ideology, because all we're really about is, hey, how can we reduce tax foreclosure in a place like the city of Detroit? Or how can we increase access to preventive health care services through community health workers? Or how can we, you know, improve the efficiency and effectiveness of public transportation systems? So we're having a lot of fun here, and I think making a difference at the same time.
Very good. Thank you, Luke Great. Schaefer from the University of Michigan, and we look forward to seeing what you come up with. Thank you for joining us.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Scroll with it. So, spring break is around the corner. I have something to look forward to.
So after this play, I think you have a week of school.
Yes, which I will be completely brain dead for.
The kids will be too. Yeah. They're ready for a spring break.
Yeah, they are.
And so then we have our week of spring break here in our area. Your spring break actually may be now.
Yeah.
But you know what we've done in the past that's been really good is last October we had, as a group, read Frankenstein, and then we discussed it. And then on Thanksgiving, that's right.
Fire bad.
And then for Thanksgiving, we read something.
Right.
The Thanksgiving Guest.
Right. By Fruitcake Truman Weather. Is it the Fruitcake Weather one?
Or no,
that's
no, no.
the wrong
that's
one.
That's a Christmas memory.
It's all I remember of Truman Capote is I love that phrase. It's Fruitcake Weather.
That's right. Yeah. But anyway, it does star Suki. Mm-hmm. We should do this again. And based on a class that I took a few weeks ago, mm-hmm. I think we figured out a book that we're going to assign our listeners.
Yes.
You could all read it with us. Mm-hmm. It is available at the library. It was a very popular book. It's very inexpensive to get on Kindle. So don't feel like that we're getting you tough.
Right.
But anyway, the book we're going to ask you to read is M.T. Anderson's Feed. Mm-hmm. And you want to give us a little introduction on what this is about?
This was published in 2010, and it is the story of a near future. This is a utopia, dystopia kind of story about a near future where every teenager has all the information that they need implanted in their psyche. They don't need to do any studying. We're very, very close to this in current times, aren't we?
Well, they're talking about it. They're implanted into you. Mm-hmm. And the idea ultimately is going to come down, is it like a Brave New World?
Right.
Where they're kind of feeding you soma and, you know, everything's happy. Everything's great. Or as these kids are finding out, as they take their trip to the moon to go do what young kids do at times.
The things I don't like to think about with my teenager.
That's right. Uh-huh. Having parties and fun.
Uh-huh.
They're all bored.
They're bored.
They're bored.
Even on the moon, they have all the knowledge they need and they are bored. We are so close to this in real life right now.
All right. So this is a young adult book. This is not for itty bitty kids. Mm-hmm. Let's just make sure we're clear on that. So, but anyway, if you've got a kid that's mature enough to handle these types of subjects. It was written for young adults. This is a good book to do. So they're on the moon, and our twist happens when all of a sudden someone hacks what we're all connected to. And all of a sudden you wake up.
Oh, boy.
To what a reality is. And the question is there, there's a girl in it. There's a boy. There's an awakening of this. It's sort of how they choose to look at their existence from that point.
There you go. There's your assignment for spring break. We will discuss it on our show on April 3rd. So get your copy of this somewhere and send us emails. If you've read this book with us, send us emails, maybe even a voicemail of what you thought about this book. We'll play it and we'll talk about it on April 3rd.
That sounds awesome.
All right. I think we have enough information to survive another week. What do you think, Chip?
As long as no one finds me with my pot of gold there, Steve.
Yeah, with your no shirt and your scotch.
Only if we can come back next week, Steve.
Yeah, I think we can come back, but we might be in the bunker waiting for the next thing to happen. If you need more information, give us a call or a text. Our phone number is 805-4104-TMS. Our website is TooMuchScrolling.com. Our email is TooMuchScrolling@gmail.com. We're on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. We're on iTunes and Stitcher and TuneIn Radio. And every day of the week, you can find our news on our news site, news.TooMuchScrolling.com. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hassenflug.
We'll see you in the future.